Good morning. It's almost 7:59 and 40 seconds, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon. At 8 o'clock on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, host Ani Haynes speaks with Julie Dorf, advisor at the Council for Global Equality, about international gay, lesbian, and trans human rights.
KBOO is proud to host A Conversation with Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, on Saturday, April 11th at the Baghdad Theater. This event is a benefit for KBOO Community Radio. KBOO's own Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza, hosts of Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, will interview Amy on stage. She will talk about her book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, and her experiences as an award-winning journalist. That's A Conversation with Amy Goodman benefit for KBOO on April 11th at noon at the Baghdad Theater in Southeast Portland. More information is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm or by phone at 503-231-8032.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Peace Works, presenting the 25th annual Give Peace a Dance benefit concert and auction, Saturday, April 11th, 6 p.m. at the Grand Ballroom in downtown Salem, with music by Linda Hornbuckle, Kate Sullivan, Jenna Summer-Smith, and political satire by Dr. Atomic's Medicine Show. Appetizers and desserts included, silent and oral auctions, and bar. Tickets at 503-585-2767 or OregonPeaceWorks.org.
Good morning. My name is Ani. It is 4 4 minutes after 8 in the morning, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, KBOO 90.7 FM, your very own community radio station. This is Morning Talk Radio, and this morning I am very happy to be speaking with Julie Dorf. Julie is the founder and former director of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, and Julie is the senior advisor at the Council for Global Equality. Our topic this morning is the state of human rights for gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people in the U.S. and around the world. Good morning, Julie. Thanks very much for joining us this morning on KBOO. We pause momentarily as we find Julie in the ether. So, just to let you know a little bit more about Julie Dorf, who we will be hearing from in just a moment, I have great confidence. Julie Dorf has been a tireless leader in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans rights movement for the last 20 years. Like I said, founding and directing the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission from 1990 to 2000, she created an organization that protects and advances the human rights of all people and communities subjected to discrimination or abuse on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, or HIV status. Julie holds a Bachelor of Arts from Wesleyan University in Russian and Soviet Studies. Ms. Dorf has written, spoken, and advocated extensively on social justice issues, widely ranging. So we hope to have her with us in just a moment. Julie, good morning. Are you there? Okay, so we are, it's always interesting with live radio to watch the engineering pixies at work because, in fact, there's never a dull moment, never a dull moment with live radio. So we will be getting to Julie in just a moment. She is on the line, and momentarily the engineering pixies will be able to put her through. So our topic is international human rights and queer rights and what the two have to do with one another. A lot of people, there's trends in really looking at recognizing queer rights as part of the overall human rights movement, to look at the rights of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans people as part and parcel with the rights of all humans everywhere, human rights to be applied to all equally. So there has been some interesting news over the last couple of months in international queer rights. A report came out by the State Department that will be part of the template of the show, as it were, as soon as we're able to get Julie actually sort of into the works here. So, good morning, Teresa. Look at you running into the studio.
Good morning. I don't think I have a live mic.
No, I don't think you do either.
Hi, live mic.
And no, I don't have a table. Well,
I'm feeling mighty queer this morning.
Never-ending cavalcade, really.
Mighty queer.
Events and things. excuse me.
Easy for you to say.
What I'm thinking at this moment is perhaps we could go back to just a little piece of music, let our listeners perhaps, as I ask the engineering pixie to grow an even additional set of arms.
Can I dance to the music?
You perhaps could.
Okay.
I could give you a play-by-play of Teresa dancing to the music, or, in fact, look at this. What's going on here? I only wish I knew. Oh, there we go. It's music, and that's fabulous. We'll be back in just a moment with Julie Dorf. morning. Good morning. So, again, this is Ani. I believe that we have achieved our guest by phone this morning. Good morning. Julie, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Ani. Thanks.
Oh, wonderful. It is so good to hear your voice.
Yes, likewise.
All right. So I just want to back up for a moment and pretend the last 7 minutes of my life never happened. So, good morning. It is about 10 after 8 in the morning. You are listening to KBOO Community Radio in Portland. And again, my name is Ani. Our guest this morning, Julie Dorf. Julie, the founder and former director of the International Gay and Lesbian and Human Rights Commission. Julie's a senior advisor at the Council for Global Equality. The topic this morning, again, is the state of human rights for gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people in the U.S. and around the world. So good morning, Julie. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Let's start our conversation with just a little more information about the Council for Global Equality. This is a group that's focused on human rights affecting gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans communities around the world. Can you describe the work of the Council?
Yeah, well, you know, we're basically a fairly new organization that got started because we knew we'd have a changed administration in the United States, and we are focused exclusively on U.S. foreign policy and the impacts on LGBT people worldwide. So our targets are Congress and the State Department and USAID and embassies around the world, and trying to get them all in sync now that we have some new leadership in this country to refocus on human rights again and reclaim our place as a leader in the world, as the United States should be, and the defender of the human rights of LGBT people.
So let's talk for a moment about the general trends in human rights extended to the LGBT communities. And let's focus actually, instead of internationally, at first blush here, let's focus at home in the U.S. We've seen progress made over the last 40 years in general in looking at accepting gay and lesbian people, at least, into non-discrimination and acceptance generally legally in the U.S., starting with removing being gay or lesbian from the mental health standards, whereas before, like 1973, we were just considered mentally ill. So we've seen progress, and I don't want to say that we haven't. At the same time, we've also seen the community targeted time and time again as a threat to God, country, and the American way of life. So it seems to me like the last couple of years in particularly have been very polarizing. What's your take on the current atmosphere vis-a-vis queer rights here at home?
Well, I think, you know, well, first of all, I think in order for the United States to be a leader globally on these issues, we've got to clean up our act here at home. You know, so just on the formal equality, we've got a lot to do. We've got to undo the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military. We've got to get rid of the Defense of Marriage Act. We've got to then, on a proactive basis, we have a lot of, federal employees who are gay and lesbian can't even get their spouses and kids on their health plans right now. I mean, we have so much to do on the federal level. There's non-discrimination in the workplace. We know that a huge majority of Americans support that, and we don't have that legislation in place yet. We've got hate crimes legislation. Anyway, there's a lot to do right now in the United States, and now is our time. While we have the Congress as it is, and while we have this president in the next 2 years before, and really in the next year before they're all focused on their reelection campaigns, you know, this is our time as a civil rights movement to claim our rights and to get them codified. But on a social level, your question is really a different question. Your question is really about, you know, the changed culture that's going on right now in our nation. And certainly marriage rights has been the catalyst for really pushing the question of how much do people really think we're okay, you know? And we've certainly finally gotten, you know, the vast majority of people in this country to believe that we should not be discriminated against. And because of that, we need to, you know, really act those non-discrimination laws that are inclusive of gender identity. And then, you know, the next step is really like, you know, are they comfortable with us and our families? Do they think that we're good enough to actually be able to get married? And that's where we're really on the tipping point. You know, the polls go up and down, and the religious right is very, very threatened by that. But the trend is in our favor, which is why the right is so upset. And, you know, the trend is, you know, certainly in our favor in the next few decades as older people, you know, move on to their next place in the world, and younger people have polled to be extremely, you know, more tolerant than prior generations. So, you know, on one hand, it's inevitable that we are going to get our full equality in this country, and on the other hand, it takes a lot of work. And it takes a lot of pulling together from gay and straight progressives to really, I mean, you guys are in Oregon. You know better than anywhere, you know, you know how easily our rights get put up for a popular vote.
Yeah, we've noticed.
And, you know, so, you know, these are critical times in the next, you know, 5-10 years.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I just want to jump back to something we touched on earlier, and that was non-discrimination legislation and the inclusion of everyone in that non-discrimination legislation. A couple years ago, we saw the Employment Non-Discrimination Act do something that I found personally abhorrent, that there were some advocates of this legislation that decided it was more politically expedient to go ahead and drop transgendered people from that coverage. And now there's a new sort of life to that legislation with the inclusion of transgendered communities. So I wanted to get your take. How close are we to actually seeing the inclusion of gender identity in trans people in non-discrimination legislation generally?
Well, you know, it's in there right now. And
how close are we to see something like that actually passing with trans people included?
Well, as someone who's not a lobbyist on that particular piece of legislation, I don't know firsthand, you know, what our numbers are. But I know that, you know, it's never been closer to being passed than it is today, that's for sure. And it seems like people are extremely optimistic about this. And I believe, you know, there's no doubt that the president would sign it if it got to his desk with gender identity in there. I mean, you hear Barney Frank and Human Rights Campaign and,
yeah,
and all the key players in Washington talking about a trans inclusive. I mean, they don't use the trans inclusive; they say gender identity, you know, inclusive bill.
Yeah.
So, you know, the good thing this time around is that our community is united about what we need and want, and so we're not going to go in publicly and have a big fight about it, which is never helpful to anybody.
No, it's
what
really,
happened last time.
Yeah, it's always an ugly situation. And
you can't expect lawmakers and policymakers to you know, decide our internal battles. We've got to figure that out before we go public, and I think we did.
Right, good. Okay, glad to hear that. Let's go ahead and expand our view out a little bit now. Last month, the State Department released a report examining the human rights record of every country around the world. It's an ambitious report. The report found that there are continuing and severe human rights abuses based on perceived sexual orientation and gender identity. So I want to look at that report for a moment. How does this report, how does the findings of this report compare with situations in the past? Are conditions generally around the world getting better or worse for gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people?
Well, you know, they're getting better and they're getting worse. I mean, that's sort of the moment in history that we're in. The report, which has been issued by the State Department to Congress ever since the Carter era, you know, looks at every single country that we have diplomatic relations with, and looks at the human rights abuses. And we have, as a movement, been pushing them to cover sexual orientation and gender identity issues since the early 90s. So the United States government, in this form, has been documenting this extreme trend of abuses on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity for, you know, almost two decades now. This particular report, the 2008 report, had the highest number of instances of human rights abuses that were documented by the government. But I don't think that's because there was necessarily a huge increase in the number. It was just that they did a better job looking at every country, which is, you know, because we started to put more pressure on them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of these you know, some of these country reports, all it says is, you know, there was societal discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or something very vague like that. Others go into great, great depth of actual instances, you know, because the political officer in the U.S. Embassy in that country actually, you know, did some homework and did some research and got involved. So, you know, it's an inconsistent report, I should say. But substantively, in 2008, you know, what I saw, since I've been looking at these reports every year for a long time, you know, the kind of trend that I saw that the U.S. really picked up on was a real increase in hate speech against LGBT people. I mean, you know, the Gambian president, you know, said he wanted to cut off the head of any homosexual in his country. The Moscow mayor called gay pride marches, you know, acts of Satan. I mean, you had you had a number of these kind of, you know, crazy homophobic, you know, statements publicly made by public officials. Not that we haven't seen that before. I mean, you know, starting with the, you know, the famous, infamous quote from President Mugabe in Zimbabwe that homosexuals are like dogs and pigs, you know, many years ago. I mean, we've seen this, you know, in all over the world, but there were a number of those types of instances. The other kind of trend that, we've seen documented by in the U.S. government report are real threats to the right of association. You know, the basic, freedom of association by LGBT people. And we've seen this in the form of, you know, the government going into a gay and lesbian organization in the Kyrgyz Republic, you know, and you know, taking their their computers and their stuff out of basically making it impossible for them to be an organization. We've seen Lambda Istanbul in Turkey lose their nonprofit status. A whole host of gay and lesbian organizations trying to have a gay pride march in Eastern Europe, not being given permits, having violent neo-Nazi skinheads attack them and the police to stand by and watch. Anyway, you know, so I think that's probably, if there's any kind of trend, is that the more visible the community is, the, you know, the more of a public reaction there is, whether it's legislative, whether it's from officials in the country or just the people. And, you know, that is widespread.
So I want to remind our listeners that they are tuned into KBOO, your very own community radio station. My name is Ani. My guest this morning is Julie Dorf. She's the senior advisor at the Council for Global Equality. We're discussing the state of human rights for gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people. We want you to join the discussion. You can call in to KBOO, and the number here is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. 8187, call in with your questions or comments. According to this report, Julie, the top 10 lists for countries with the worst conditions include Egypt, Honduras, India, Lithuania, Jamaica, Kuwait, Nigeria, Uganda, you had mentioned, Gambia. Can you, let's look at those countries and what's occurring today in those countries that, is such cause for concern. You had just gone into sort of generally the rights of association and whatnot, but more specifically in these countries, what's happening, for example, in India?
Well, let me just first say an important thing. We didn't actually do the top 10 worst countries. We deliberately didn't do that. What we pulled out from the 2008 report were the top 10 opportunities for the United States to make a difference.
Right.
So, you know, there's countries where, you know, you could still, you know, be put to death for being gay, but our relations with those countries are not so good that, you know, there's not, you know, there's not as, it's not really an opportunity for the United States to make a significant difference for LGBT people. So anyway, I just want to, you know, correct.
That's an important distinction. It is.
It is important because there's a lot of places where the United States doesn't have, you know, strong enough diplomatic relations, and where, you know, or for whatever bunch of combination of reasons, there's not an opportunity for the U.S. government to make a huge difference. So what we pulled out were places where, you know, for a variety of reasons, we feel the U.S. government could really make a difference and change the daily lived, you know, experience of LGBT people. So you asked about India. India is a very interesting, you know, country because it's obviously it's very big. It has a very robust LGBT movement and civil society movement in general, and one that is very, very proud of their incredibly strategic and smart organizing, and that, you know, doesn't necessarily need a lot of or want a lot of external attention, you know, and, you know, Western influence. And so they've had a sodomy law on the books for many, many years, you know, like half of the 80 sodomy laws that exist in the world, they're still remnants of British colonization. So India, as a former British colony, still has Article 377. They're all almost named the same throughout the former British colonies. Britain has undone their sodomy law, but nonetheless, their legacy lives on.
Right.
And so in India, you know, what the report focused on was less about the sodomy law and more about the actual violence against transgender people, or hijras, as they're locally known and understood. And, you know, so we had a number of incidents. The one that was mentioned in the report is in Bangalore, where there's, you know, unfortunately, a whole host of documentation of police abuse against the transgender community there. And, you know, although the, you know, that level of, you know, anti-trans violence, I mean, you know, unfortunately we could see that anywhere in the world, a lot of, in this country as well.
We can see that in Portland.
Yes, exactly. But in the context of India, you have, you know, some very, very strong coalitions between labor groups and human rights groups and LGBT groups and the HIV community, and they are all coming together trying to undo the sodomy law in that country. And so there's a court case that is winding its way very slowly to the Indian Supreme Court, and we're very hopeful that they will overturn their sodomy law in the next few years. If that is the case, then you know, we hope that will also have a ripple effect, at least in South Asia, where there's other countries with these same laws in place. Now, the U.S. has a very close relationship with India.
Right.
Now, I don't think this is the kind of situation where our public, you know, pressure about the sodomy law would do any good. Oh, it could even backfire. But I do think behind the scenes, diplomatic, bilateral conversations where, you know, the U.S., one of the things the United States has are these wonderful lead experts in our various embassies that come from the Justice Department. And, you know, those we could have legal experts in, you know, helping. You know, we undid our sodomy laws here just back in 2003. That's very recent history.
Exactly.
You know, and we could, you know, help them out to, you know, look at what, you know, what how did that happen here? And why? And what's been the benefit of that? And, you know, it doesn't have to be a hard-hitting, like, you know, you rights abuser, but rather, you know, a helpful hand as an ally saying,
right,
oh, we had this problem a few years ago, too, and this is what we did.
Right, right. For the last 6 years, we've, you know, been doing the right thing.
Right.
So you're kind of already hitting on this, but what kind of pressure? You had mentioned USAID, diplomatic relations, all manner of types of things to be used to bring countries around to better human rights treatment, better conditions for the LGBT communities. What specifically can listeners do to try to help that process?
Well, first of all, we have a website, globalequality.org, and we are structured actually as a coalition of, at the moment, 12 organizations, and basically half are international human rights groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and Global Rights and Human Rights First, the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, and then we're also, the other half are LGBT advocacy organizations that have a federal policy focus. So we're actually a group of groups who are coming together to have a common and coordinated agenda vis-a-vis the foreign policy sides of government. So first of all, I really encourage listeners, gay or straight, to go to our website, and from there you can also see link off to all the other coalition members, and they have more grassroots programs and more action alerts and lists to get on, although you should get on our list as well so you're informed. I mean, information is the first thing, but then there's regular calls for action that come from all of our member organizations. So I think that's the best way for listeners to get involved. I think the U.S. government, our pressure on the U.S. government is multifold. There are so many, I really believe that, although this hasn't been the case for most of my lifetime, but that the U.S. government should be a force for good in the world. And we have amazing numbers of programs.
I love your optimism. That is awesome.
There are so many different programs that we can, that LGBT civil society around the world should be able to take part in. There's training opportunities. There's a huge amount of development assistance. I mean, Egypt was our number one, country in our top 10 opportunities because they're the third largest recipient of foreign aid from the United States.
Uh-huh.
And not that we think that, we would have the political power to tie that aid to, changes in policy in those countries, but we can creatively use that lever as a nation to say to the country that is so dependent on our foreign aid, hey, you know what? These guys that are in prison because they're HIV positive, that's not okay. We gotta let's direct some of this money to actually help do some human rights courses in your nation on HIV, on the rights of people with HIV, or things like that. I think are enormous opportunities in this coming period when we have changed leadership in these agencies in the United States.
And let's hold it right there for just a moment. I want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show. If you have questions or comments, you can call in at 503-231-8187. And I want to talk a moment about that, a couple of things that I've noted in that change in our administration recently. But first, let's hear from LJ. Good morning, LJ. You're on the air.
Hi, Ani. Thank you so much for taking my call. Honey, I've got a real problem here. I hope you can help me out.
Okay, let's try.
All right. All of the translators that spoke Farsi, right, in the military, when we needed them, were sort of invited to leave the military service because of their sexuality. Remember?
No, I don't. But that's okay. Go right ahead.
All right. Anyway, so and now it seems that people people for their because of their sexual preference are being asked to leave the military, and I understand that the military is now recruiting felons from prisons to take their places.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I will certainly take my answers off the air.
Julie, do you have any response or comment?
Well, I believe it was Arabic translators and not Farsi.
And not Farsi.
But there's been a lot of attention paid to a very small number of Arabic translators who were dismissed from military service because of our don't ask, don't tell policy right at the time when this nation really needs them for our security purposes. And I think, I think the caller points out to, how counterproductive so many U.S. policies are that undermine our security. I mean, my colleague Michael Guest, who was the former ambassador to Romania, left the State Department after a 26-year career in diplomacy. I mean, a very senior, seasoned diplomat for this country. And he couldn't bring his same-sex partner with him on the, on the dime of the U.S. government, as he could if he were straight. But more importantly, his partner couldn't join security briefings for family members, which puts our nation at risk, because as a spouse of the you know, ambassador to Romania, he's been perfect, you know, and a gay spouse at that, you know, he's, you know, a perfect target for, you know, espionage and, you know, other, you know, issues that would be, you know, problematic and potentially to U.S. security. So the don't tell military policy and the dismissal of key personnel, and we did have a shortage of Arab translators, you know, in the post-9/11 world. You know, those stories are just perfect examples of how counterproductive these policies are in the U.S. government, and that how desperately we need them to be undone.
Why is this everyone's issue? Why should everyone actually be concerned about the treatment and rights of members of the LGBT communities?
Well, you know, kind of like the best argument our community has had with the business community, you know, on this particular topic, it's obvious we're not getting the best labor pool when we restrict it to straight people or closeted gay people, you know, and we know from study after study that gay people perform better on the job. They're more productive workers in the workforce when they're open and feel safe. And if they're closeted and scared, they're not going to be as good a worker. So, you know, from purely a bottom line sense, regardless of how you feel sort of ethically and politically about equality issues, which hopefully people do care about, you know, if all you care about is dollars and cents, and we're in a pretty difficult financial time, one should want the best labor pool. One should want the most productive workers. Our government should want the best trained Arab translators, you know, and we're not getting them. We're not getting the best diplomats in the Foreign Service when we are not treating our gay and lesbian employees equally.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that. I just want to branch out for just a moment without wandering too far afield, but I'm just really honored to have you on with us this morning, and don't want to let the opportunity escape without asking about, you know, as somebody who's worked in this field for 20 years and who's looked at international human rights issues in regards to vis-a-vis the sexual minority and gender identity communities, do you see any correlation between discrimination and criminalization of gay, lesbian, bi, and trans people and the oppression of women?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that the worst crimes, I mean, the most horrific crimes we see, and prolific, are to the trans community. The reason, you know, behind this kind of really grotesque treatment it's usually with trans women, so men who have chosen to become women, you know, is a combination, a clear combination of homophobia and, you know, and sexism, and, you know, how, you know, and it's so irrational and universal that I think by far the, you know, you really see those two bigot trees come together in the form of particularly transphobic violence. But, you know, I think, you know, I've been really sickened recently by, I was in South Africa a couple months ago, and you know, there's a lot of countries in the world where violence against women is enormously high, you know, is intolerably high.
Right.
And then, you know, layer on the lesbian factor, and you see, you know, a whole phenomenon of curative rape, for example, by you know, men in the family or friends of the family who are trying to, you know, help this poor lesbian, you know, come back to heterosexuality through rape, and you know, or honor killings, or, I mean, you see just an enormous number of places where the second class status of women, you know, really dovetails with the homophobia, and they, you know, have horrible treatment. And because women, for the most part, in many parts of the world, have less money, they're not able to get out of their countries to seek asylum as often as gay men are. And because they're in lots of parts of the world are really relegated their public space is relegated so much that a lot of the real crimes against lesbians occur in the realm of the family,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the state. And international human rights law as a tool for social change is really very much focused on holding governments accountable, not families or churches, you know,
right.
synagogues or mosques. And so, you know, there's a real, there's a real struggle to first make these crimes visible,
right,
and then be able to hold, you know, the violators accountable. We have fewer tools to do that.
And you had mentioned, I just have to say, you had mentioned curative rape, you know, so-called curative rape, as a practice that's often used against lesbians worldwide. And I just don't want to be remiss in saying that that is still common in the U.S. Within families, within communities. It happened to me. And so, you know, as we look around the world at the abuses that happen elsewhere, I think it's also, we just can't stress enough that we have so much work to do here at home, socially and politically.
Absolutely. I mean, I hate the question of, like, what are the worst countries in the world, because mm-hmm. they're all bad.
Right.
The problem is they're all bad. There's no, you know, there's no safe, perfect, you know, place for us, although I have to say my 10-year-old daughter post Prop 8 and out here in California keeps saying, I think we should move to Canada because you'll get all your rights there, Mom.
and they make a damn good cup of tea.
thank goodness we don't, you know, have our heads chopped off for being gay in
yeah.
this country, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a hell of a lot of work to do.
Indeed. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you would like to get on the air with a question or comment this morning. My name's Ani, and I'm happy to be speaking with Julie Dorff. Julie is the founder and director of the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, and she's the senior advisor at the Council for Global Equality. So again, 503-231-8187. Another thing you quickly mentioned was asylum, and how oftentimes women lack the resources to seek political asylum elsewhere. But that did bring to mind the whole question of asylum and what is the U.S. doing, or what can the U.S. do to actually provide political asylum for victims of mistreatment because of their sexual identity or gender identity.
Well, you know, I have to say that the U.S. government has been, you know, really quite good in that arena since the kind of mid-90s when the Attorney General Janet Reno helped us as a community by creating a policy that interpreted membership in a social group, which is a legal basis for asylum, to be interpreted by the then INS as inclusive of sexual orientation. I don't think it was gender identity at the time, although many trans people have gotten asylum in this country. And these State Department human rights reports, I mean, part of the reason we started focusing on them back in that period of time was because that was a definitive source for the government in determining whether or not this person was potentially fleeing actual real persecution. I mean, you have to prove your case with facts about your own individual case, but it helps a lot if the country report says, you know, things are bad or things, you know, these types of abuses occur. So we have for many, many years now allowed people to claim asylum in the United States on the basis of sexual orientation. And in fact, you know, one of the things that has been interesting is that it's actually quite difficult to get asylum on the basis of sex in this country. And the treatment of, you know, the horrible treatment of women in many parts of the world, for a whole variety of reasons. But, you know, I think as an LGBT movement, you know, we've done okay. Now, that doesn't mean that people can get here very easily or that every case is that there isn't a lot of room for some training, you know, of the immigration officials in this country. There certainly is. Where the United States could do a little bit more in this arena is our participation globally in refugee issues and being able to really be a leader on these kinds of things. I mean, there's individual cases, but then there are cases that come to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and they have to figure out where to send, what's really a global disaster of people who have no homes because, of war and famine and all kinds of reasons. You know, there are many, many refugees in the world. And the U.S. has not necessarily been, has not really necessarily indicated that we're open to getting gay refugees. So, for example, there's many gay Iraqi refugees right now in safe houses that have, that need homes. And we think the U.S. should open itself up and be a safe haven for some of the LGBT refugees and not just the asylum seekers who already get themselves here.
Right. Julie, last week the Obama administration announced their support for the UN statement on human rights, sexual orientation, and gender identity.
Yahoo!
Right? Can you talk about that for a moment? What does that mean, actually?
Yeah, well, it doesn't truthfully mean a lot in terms of legal enforcement, but it's a huge victory for us and for, the hopefulness that we should all have with the new administration that they are going to, over time be good on, he's going to be good on his word and his promises to our community. But yes, this statement that was made at the UN was really just that. It was a statement. And there were 66 nations, almost the entire Western bloc at the UN, with the exception of the United States, signed on. And it basically affirmed that we, these nations, believe that international human rights standards apply to people on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, and specifically that we call for the decriminalization of homosexuality around the world. So the 80 countries where it is illegal to, really illegal, to be gay, to call for that change in the world. And at the very end of the Bush administration, he refused to let the United States sign on. They came up with this kind of cockamamie legal reason why, because we didn't have non-discrimination laws, that we couldn't, that this would somehow,
that we wouldn't quite meet the bar ourselves, so we can't sign on to it for other people.
The only good news was that the former Bush administration did not sign on to a counter statement that was mainly pushed by the Islamic Conference and the Vatican, called homosexuals akin to bestiality and incest, and it was, this horribly homophobic statement. At least the United States did not sign on to that.
Thank God for small favors.
Right. fortunately, the then transition team paid attention to this, and they asked us to brief them on it, and so we were delighted that they very publicly both through a press conference at the State Department and then the next week at the Human Rights Council meeting in Vienna, that they, very publicly announced formally to their peers, and that's really who the intended audience was, was the other nations of the world, that yes, this administration would have signed on, even though, it already occurred, but they'll sign on next time, and that, it was really a question of leadership. It's saying, the United States, strongly supports this statement and will work, to end criminalization on the basis of sexual orientation. The U.S. has never made that policy statement before. And I can tell you some of the career people inside of the Foreign Service were very much took notice of this statement because it came from the top. And, are very pleased to be able to work more closely with our organization and our movement.
Excellent. I want to let folks know, coming up at 9 o'clock this morning, in just about 10 minutes, we will hear One Land, Many Voices. Host Will Seaman will be, and the guest host, Wael Al-Assadi, will speak with Deputy Director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza and a representative of Anarchists Against the Wall about political prisoners in Israel and Israeli war crimes in Gaza. At 10 o'clock, you'll hear Air Cascadia. That's headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, Flashpoints, featuring a talk by journalist and author Ali Abunima about Gaza. And at 11 o'clock, The Digital Divide presents the latest in science and technology affecting our planet with a focus on the recent South by Southwest Interactive Conference. So all of that coming up on your very own community radio station between now and noon. Of course, at noon, you can hear Moving On, politically inspired and conscious folk music. And, you know, you can just stay tuned to KBOO, your community radio station, for all of your aural needs. So I'm Ani. I'm here with Julie Dorf. We are talking about human rights and queer rights internationally and at home. And our number is 503-231-8187. We'd love to welcome you to the air with your question or comments. In getting back to that, just the sort of sea change that we're seeing, I mean, personally, I do feel like perhaps I have become an absolute cynic in terms of looking at federal administrations one after another, sort of disappointing me throughout my entire life. And yet, during the Obama inauguration speech, when he actually had the words gay and lesbian people come out of his mouth, I was kind of blown away by that.
Yeah.
And so in seeing that perhaps there is a change and an opening, an opportunity to at this point move forward, again, I just want to pause for a moment and well, I want to go two directions at the same time, so let's try this first. According to the Council for Global Equality, there's a statement, the U.S. needs to make clear that the fair, equal treatment of LGBT individuals is a matter of conscience for our country, and that patterns of LGBT abuse and discrimination in other countries will negatively impact our relationships. You say that administration and congressional officials should carry that message in their meetings with foreign officials in Washington and abroad, and that our ambassadors should inquire officially whenever abuses occur, and should be very outspoken about America's fundamental values in denouncing these abuses. Are these things happening yet?
You know, they've been happening in inconsistent ways, and we are, you know, we created this organization to be able to hold our government more consistently accountable. So just to take a little example, you know, a few months back under the Bush administration, there was a politically appointed ambassador to Honduras. Now, these appointments we monitor, and then we help friendly members of Congress ask them questions for our community. So that particular appointee, you know, we had a question for the record about the violence against LGBT people in that country, and what was, you know, as ambassador, what were you going to do about it? Now, the ambassadors want to get appointed, right? So
right.
They're briefed ahead of time, and they usually give a pretty decent answer. They don't, I mean, he's not going to say, I don't care about those people, you know?
Right, right. Or at least, you know, one hopes.
Right. You know, and so, and this particular ambassador was quite good. And the truth is that a lot of stuff, it's been a very active nation in terms of abuse against LGBT people. And so, you know, he got the job. And they contacted us proactively to get to get the LGBT groups and leaders they should meet with in the country, and they met. And, you know, and unfortunately, there was an incident earlier this year, and the U.S. government, you know, was supportive and did basically all the right things that we would have wanted them to do. So now, you know, that's mm-hmm. one out of, you know, 200 countries in the world.
Sure.
So this, you know, there's a lot of work to do. But that's a model example of what we want.
And just to let folks know what's going on in Honduras, I know we're quickly running out of time, but Honduras has an appalling record of violations of gay and transgender rights.
Yeah, unfortunately, very high violence, killings, attacks, you know, the lack of sufficient police protection and, you know, really in some cases looking like the security officials are really the ones, you know, in cahoots with rape and assault on, you know, gays in detention. It's, you know, it, yeah, there's plenty to do there. You know, there's been other reports by other intergovernmental agencies that have really looked at Honduras and said, you know, this is a disaster. You know, this can't go on. So, you know, there's a tension diplomatically, not just from the United States, but from elsewhere in the region as well.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, just this month alone, you know, I just kind of blown away the other day, sitting there feeling a little overwhelmed myself the day that transgender activist was murdered in Turkey. A couple days later, a gay man who was also an activist in Colombia was killed. You know, there's still these guys in prison in Uganda who were, all they were doing was doing a training on safer sex and had condoms in a public location, and they're all in prison. There's 45 gay men were just arrested in Morocco. In Nigeria and Uganda, you have these religious right, all this North American ex-gay, you know, leaders who are kind of losing their audiences here in North America, you know, are exporting their seminars and doing these incredibly public events in other parts of the world, stirring up the religious right there. I mean, I just, you know, there's times when, you know, it's just crazy the number of places that this stuff is going on unchecked, and where, you know, the U.S. government needs to be involved and doing the right thing and standing up for what we say we believe in terms of equality and justice and fairness for all people. I think it's a real opportunity for the Obama administration to signal the incredible change. You put gay stuff on, you know, to the side for a moment. We've lost a lot of credibility in the world on human rights because of our own violations over the last 8 years. You know, the Abu Ghraib being the most, you know, well-known horrors that occurred, you know, by the hands of U.S. government officials. And so, you know, we need to very seriously signal. I mean, that's why I was a very early Obama administration, and I thought he would signify to the world the greatest amount of change from prior practices. And there's a great opportunity on LGBT issues, not just because the violations are so severe and grotesque, but because it really will help align us with the true human rights leaders that have consistently been out there in the world, and not just the Europeans, but Argentina. And
I was going to ask you, actually, that was the last question I wanted to get to this morning, was who do you see the nations that are actually leading the way at this moment?
Well, for example, that UN statement was read by Argentina, which was, you know, very honored to be out there doing, on our behalf. The precursor to this statement was by Brazil. We've had for decades, we've had the sort of all the Nordic states, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Iceland. Recently, I mean, the Czech Republic, for example, has really come on board with this. A lot of the former, not all, but a lot of the former Soviet countries and countries that are trying to become part of the EU are really starting to come around. The Ukraine joined again, which was the first. We had a number of, smaller countries, but nonetheless very important, you know, taking a stand from Africa and, incredible advances in Asia. Nepal had a really important court case last year that really threw the rights of the Metis, who are essentially what we would call transgender people or folks who straddle both genders, of being able to, you know, a Supreme Court case that now offers them a third gender option on their passport, on their identity paper.
Right. Julie, we're going to have to stop you there because we are out of time. Can you let folks know how to get a hold of you just very quickly? We have about 30 seconds left.
globalequality.org.
Thank you very much, Julie, for joining us this morning. I'm Ani, and I have been speaking with Julie Dorff, the senior advisor for the Council for Global Equality. Julie, thank you so much for joining us. And we hope you stay tuned to KABU for One Land, Many Voices throughout this morning, followed by more informational programming and Moving On there at noon. Again, Democracy Now! Replayed at 4 p.m., the evening news at 5 p.m. Stay tuned to your community radio station. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and take care.
Good. It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to KBOO in Portland.
KABU has 2 open board seats and would like to conduct interviews with interested candidates. Those with skills in finance, nonprofit operations, and strategic planning are particularly encouraged to apply. Please call 503-516-3882 and leave a brief message with a phone number or email address at which you may be contacted. The deadline for applications is Monday, April 13th. Interviews will be conducted during the April 20th board meeting, which begins at 6 p.m.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation's annual Justice Within Reach benefit event, Saturday, April 4th at Payer. The event celebrates stories of hope and justice from around the state. The party features DJ Adiva, a.k.a. KABU Celeste Carey, in the MRG Foundation/KABU Community Story Booth, where guests can record their own stories of hope and justice. That's the MRG Foundation's Justice Within Reach benefit Saturday, April 4th at Pear, downtown Portland at Northwest 6th and Flanders. More information, including guidelines for the story booth, available on the MRG Foundation website, www.mrgfoundation.org.
It is 9:02, and you are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis and Albany, and you can find us on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up today on KABU, up next, One Land, Many Voices, host Will Seaman and guest host Wael El-Sadeh speak with the Deputy Director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza and a representative of Anarchists Against the Wall about political prisoners in Israel and Israeli war crimes in Gaza. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints featuring a talk by journalist and author Ali Abu Nima about Gaza. And at 11, the Digital Divide presents the latest in science and technology affecting our planet with a focus on the recent South by Southwest Interactive Conference. Stay tuned to KABU.
KABU is a proud co-sponsor of Tar Sands Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent with author Andrew Nikiforuk. Proceeds will benefit KABU Community Radio. This presentation will explore the dangers and destructiveness of tar sand oil production, a signature of peak oil. The event is sponsored by Alliance for Democracy and the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. That's Tar Sands with author Andrew Nikiforuk, Tuesday, March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. More information is available by phone 503-232-5495.
The preceding silence has been brought to you by the people at KABU who wish you would support us during our fundraising drives, as listeners provide nearly all of our annual funding. Visit kboo.fm anytime to make a donation. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman. Hologores is on holiday today, but with me in the studio to co-host this morning is the founder of Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, Mr. Wael El-Assadi. Good morning, Wael.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Will.
And good morning to all of our listeners. This morning we return...
This morning we return to the discussion of Israel's December and January 22-day offensive in Gaza. We have on the phone from Gaza the deputy director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, Mr. Jaber Washah, and apparently we have some technical difficulties, but we'll, you know, soon hopefully have him on the phone. And we'll be talking about some recent reports with him issued by the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. But in line with today's public affairs special theme on political prisoners, we'll also be talking about political prisoners in Palestine, Israel.
That's right. Our guest this morning, Mr. Washah, was imprisoned for 15 years by the Israeli state, the occupation authority. A little later on, we'll be talking with a key organizer for the Anarchists Against the Wall, Mr. Yonatan Pollack. But now we're going to go to our first guest as soon as we get him on the phone. I'd like to ask Wael about some events that are coming up soon. You have a film showing this coming Thursday, is that right?
That's correct. Thursday, April 2nd at Portland State University. It'll be at the Multicultural Center in the Smith Building, and we'll be showing a film called Peace and Propaganda in the Promised Land, and it'll be at 5 p.m.
And is there any admission for that?
There is not. No, it's going to be free, and we're going to have pizza and refreshments for everybody.
Have you seen the film?
I actually haven't seen that one, no. So it will be my first time watching it as well, but I've heard a lot of good things about it.
Now, also this Sunday, I believe, this weekend, there's a meeting of a particular organization that's relevant to the topics we're talking about. What's that meeting?
That's the regional meeting, annual dinner for APEC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. And there's going to be a protest this Sunday at the Middleton Jewish Center. And we're hoping a lot of people show up. As you well know, APEC's a very right-wing group that is that promotes a very aggressive policy of war in the Middle East. So we hope a lot of people show up to that.
Yeah, they're often called a pro-Israel lobby, from my perspective at least, and I think from the perspective of many Israelis. They would call them a lobby in favor of the an expansionist foreign policy, very pro-settlement. I think from the standpoint of many Israelis, a disaster for the policies of settlement and continuing occupation. Now, our guest is on the phone. I want to remind our listeners that if you'd like to take part in the conversation this morning, you can call us here at 503-231-8187. That's, again, 503-231-8187 if you'd like to take part in this morning's conversation, if you have any questions. Now, let's start with the work of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza. First off, I want to tell our listeners that they can access the reports and press releases of the PCHR, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, from their website at www.pchrgaza.org. You can get on their email list to receive their reports. It's an excellent resource. We're going to be talking about that some more very soon.
And Mr. Jaber Washah, tell us a little bit about the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, a bit about its history and the work you do there, if you're on the line, if you can hear us.
Yes. Good morning. Good morning for our audience in the States and all our audience. From Gaza, directly, I send my greetings for all of you. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights was inaugurated in 1987 de jure. I mean, that was a group of human rights activists, lawyers. They started the work of monitoring, documenting the violations against the human rights perpetrated or by the Israeli occupying force at that time. So this lasted till 1993 when Oslo Accord was concluded, and then my colleagues, I refer to this with my colleagues because later I think in the program the audience will know why I mention my colleagues. So my colleagues sat and discussed after the Oslo Accord whether Oslo Accord will change the mandate, the agenda that PCHR is working at or not. So they came to a conclusion after a couple of weeks of discussion that even after Oslo Accord was concluded between the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and the Israeli government at that time, in spite of this conclusion of the accord, but the occupation is still there. Physically, legally, politically, and so the even Gaza Strip with the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, which is considered, hello?
You're still on, yes.
Yeah, which is considered according to the international humanitarian law as occupied territories. So even after concluding Oslo Accord, they are still occupied territories considered. Even after the withdrawal of the Israeli, the physical withdrawal of the Israeli soldiers from the West Bank, from Jericho and from Gaza Strip, but still occupied territories, regardless the Palestinian Authority inauguration. So this also brought a new burden on the shoulders of our colleagues, of the human rights activists, that before we worked on one solo agenda, the violation of human rights by the Israeli occupying force, and after Oslo Accord, also a new burden, a new agenda was opened, which is the violation of human rights perpetrated by the Palestinian authority apparatuses, the security apparatuses, and so on, because Oslo Accord was putting a ceiling, restrictions, political restrictions, and other restrictions.
Mr. Wisha, I wonder if we could turn to the recent reports that you've done.
Yes.
Basically focused on the recent offensive by the Israeli military in Gaza. You've released a new series of testimonies looking into the aftermath of the Israeli attacks. Could you tell us about those testimonies and why you chose to issue this kind of report?
Yes. Actually, since the first day of the offensive, we were following the and documenting everything of as much as we could reach. So we came up after the double checking several times of our lists. We came up with these figures that as aftermath of the Israelis' offensive, 1,417 of the Palestinians were dead, including 926 were civilians, and 255 civil police officers were killed, and 236 were militants and fighters of groups, Hamas and other militant groups. Out of the civilians, 313 were children, and 116 116 women. This is a very, very, according to our work, this is a very credible and reliable number that we are responsible for publishing them.
A quick question about that. In the press release, something that stands out is that you separated civilians from combatants, but you also separated out the police who were killed, both from the civilians and from the combatants. Why did you use this third category? Why weren't they included in the civilian casualties?
According to international humanitarian law, any civil police should be considered a civilian. People who are members of police, of the government, and any civil defense as well, once they are not participating effectively in the hostilities, in the confrontation, and they are away, they are allied from their weapons, they are not participating effectively in these battles, they are considered civilians. Civilians, we consider combatants, those who carry weapons, those who in uniform, and they were participating in the resistance vis-a-vis against the Israeli army and troops. But many casualties, many killings took place in massive killings during the war at their homes. So here the policemen are considered, according to international humanitarian law and international law, they are considered civilians. By this figure, we really contest the distortion of the numbers that came up newly by the Israeli spokesman, Israeli military spokesman, and the Institute Counter-Terrorism in Jerusalem. So, and we published the names, the details of the whole casualties and with the categorization.
I want to go to a recent statement by a local talk radio host here in Portland. But I think first, let's go to our first caller. We do have a caller on the line waiting, so let's go to our first caller. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You have a question for our guest.
Yes, I do. My name is Kamal Hassan, and I'm a Palestinian refugee born in Lebanon because of Israeli aggression in 1948. I just want to tell your guest how proud I am, and every Palestinian and every American peace activist in the world, of the people of Gaza and their standing against aggression. My question is, everybody in the world knows who Gilad Shalit is. He's the Israeli soldier that was captured by Hamas, and he was about to do harm on the Palestinian people in Gaza. And we have 11,000 Palestinian political prisoners that have been rotting in jail for many, many years, with nobody is even discussing that. I would like your guest to elaborate why the media of the world and the human rights groups do not bring this issue up to forth, so people can know what the Palestinians go through on a daily basis. Thank you.
Mr. Wisha, did you hear the question?
Yes, I hear the question, and my colleague referred me back to something personal that that happened with me around 12 years ago. Actually, I am my colleague, my friend. I am one of the Palestinian ex-prisoners who spent really, I hate count them in years, who spent 5,200 61 days, 5,261 nights away from my family, my beloved two daughters, my beloved wife, mother, and my colleagues in the Israeli jails. I am speaking out of personal experience and professional, of course, commitment to speak the truth, the whole truth. Believe me, colleague, and allow me to address all our respectful audience that we are completely convinced when we were inside the Israeli jails, and now while I am a human rights defender and activist, that suffering has no passport. The suffering of the mother of Gilad Shalit, the captured soldier, the Israeli soldier in the arms of the Palestinian militant groups, is exactly as the suffering of the thousands of mothers, as you mentioned now, about 11,000 political prisoners, women, children, even under age of 18, and old men now in the Israeli jail. I completely agree with you that there is a very shameful shortage of media coverage about the suffering of those political prisoners who fought for their freedom, who simply resisted the occupation, which is a legitimate right for them to defend their land, to defend their community, to defend their country against the occupiers, the Israeli occupying force. Now, I through the Kapu radio, I send my call to stop this unilateral, to stop this dual policy, the dual policy of the double phase policy. Okay, I'm not against shedding light on the issue of to release Gilad Shalit, but also in the same time, with the same strength, I call to release my colleagues, the women, the children, the sick political prisoners inside the Israeli jails, and I call here the Israeli the government and all those who have influence on Israeli government to deal with the human dimension and to conclude this bargain, or to conclude this exchange, that they stopped it intentionally.
And we're listening to Deputy Director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, Mr. Jaber Wisha, who is with us on a phone line from Gaza. I wonder if we could run those two audio clips from a local talk show host, who we're going to listen to a perspective that I think is heard all too often on local radio. We'll just run that right now.
All terrorists are, by definition, civilians. They're not members of the military. They're not members of the police. So if you're going to shoot terrorists, you have to shoot civilians who are terrorists.
I can't believe you're even saying this, Laura.
Why not?
That was one of our local talk show hosts describing what he felt was going on in Gaza, and that was that, yes, civilians are being killed, but those civilians are terrorists. Terrorists are all civilians, and therefore, if you're going to kill terrorists, you have to kill civilians. Mr. Wisha, could you respond to that kind of reasoning?
Actually, according to the international law and international humanitarian law, the principle of distinction should be applied in the confrontation or in hostilities in the war. The proportionality as well. The distinction between competent and non-competent, between civilian and resistance or militant, should be strictly and clearly applied, this principle. So Israel, which considers itself a state above the law, and also injects in through a very, very prolonged process of indoctrination to the soldiers that you are completely, you are 100% immune. You will not be asked, you will not be questioned if you commit crimes, kill the children. And also I call the respectable audience and to refer to Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper, and to listen and to read the testimonies of the soldiers, of the Israeli soldiers who participated in the last offensive, and now they are giving their testimonies that they were committing, and they committed completely war crimes against humanity, and even they were not doing this by their own mind on their responsibility, but according to instructions given to their to them by their commanders.
Mr. Washa, on that point, I was reading over some of the testimonies that were provided by the PCHR, and there were some testimonies about direct and blatant killing of civilians that were holding white flags trying to escape the area of combat. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. Really, really, to this, this is not a solo event. This happened in the middle Gaza Strip, and it happened in Azbat Abid Rabbo, in the north of Gaza as well. And also, I personally visited during our work, of course, and accompanying the fact-finding missions and investigation missions that came investigating the events through Amnesty International, through Human Rights Watch, through the UNRWA investigation. This event actually many it repeated itself, that the soldiers asked the women to get out of the house raising flags, and even while they were raising white flags, and the tanks were about 150 meters away only from them, they were shot. And more than that, they were left bleeding. Imagine, they were left bleeding without letting their sons just to drag them and to give them the first aid. They were the first aid, the ambulances, ICRC, were the what we call it, the Red Crescent, the Red Cross. They were not allowed, the paramedics, they were not allowed to reach the injured people to evacuate them. More than that, the dead bodies, they were not, the rescue crew, they were not allowed to just to drag the dead bodies, the corpse out of the, and they were left under piles of sand by the bulldozers, 16 days. Imagine a person, a child, a daughter, was witnessing her mother buried under the rubble, under the sand by the bulldozers, without being able just to give her a bury of dignity. This is incredible. Incredible what happened. Incredible. And here I call all those who have minds, those peace seekers, to follow the issues and to confront the false propaganda of the Israelis vis-a-vis this brutal offensive on Gaza Strip.
And we're talking with Deputy Director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, Jaber Wisha, and he's referring to a report which you can view, the entire report, at their website, which is pchrgaza.org. That's pchrgaza.org. It's called Aftermath. It has some very moving photographs, but even more important, these remarkable testimonies of Gazans who experienced firsthand the Israeli aggression in December and January of this year. We have a caller on the phone. Caller, if you'd like to ask a question of our guest. Yes, please, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. This is Hira Wishah. I'm actually the daughter of Jaber Wishah.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I actually want to agree with the first caller that we have to do something about the prisoners in the Israeli jails. In that occasion, I would like to share a little bit of my personal experience as being a daughter of an ex-prisoner. My dad was taken to the prison when I was 2 years old. My sister was 6 months, so we couldn't really understand the impact of this until we grew up. I remember one day when I went to the prison to visit my dad and I wanted to talk to him, I called him uncle instead of dad because I'm not used to the word dad. Mother taught us to keep the hope every day. Every doorbell was a hope for us. We were disappointed 100 times until our dad was released. At the beginning, I felt very weird having my dad at home, so I would stay at my room, wouldn't talk to him, avoiding interaction, but he was like very intelligent that he broke this ice and we're like so close together now. After being released, I noticed that I started to forget all about this experience as if I wanted to. Me, being his daughter, the ex-prisoner daughter, started to forget this. So I wouldn't blame all the other people who wouldn't care about these prisoners. The voice in my head every day says that we should do something about them. The world should do something about these families who are suffering out there. So I would appreciate this. I would appreciate your voices. I would appreciate your help to show this case to the whole world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling.
Hi, how are you? How are you, Fida? Fida? How are you, Fida? Fida?
Fida,
yeah.
Please stay with us, Fida. We have some more questions for you, and yes, continue the conversation with your father. This is wonderful. This is great radio.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hi, Fida.
Hi, Dad.
This highlights so starkly the impact of political prisoners. Isn't just the political prisoners, the family that you mentioned. How many brothers and sisters do you have, Fida?
I only have one sister because he was taken to prison when she was 6 months, so they couldn't get any other, you know, brothers and sisters.
Yeah. Well.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello. Yes, actually, Fida, now she now allow me that I'm very, very in a very emotional status. So, actually, when this referred me to the first day of my arrest in the 5th of June in 1985, and when the soldiers, two dozens of soldiers broke down into my and to our house in order to drag me out of my family. So Fida was at that time 2 years old, and her sister Hanin, Hanin means in Arabic nostalgia in English. Hanin, she was 6 months only. I drew near to Fida. I kissed her the farewell kiss, and I insisted to go in order to kiss Hanin while she was in the cradle. The soldiers refused, and a dispute or about some sort of quarrel that took place at my home, that I insist to give her the farewell kiss, the baby. The officer came quickly from outside saying, what's wrong, what's wrong? So the soldiers told them that he insists to give a kiss to his baby in the cradle, in the room. And he, in order to avoid the, because it was after midnight, in order to avoid our neighbors getting out and make trouble and a fuss, he asked the soldiers to let me quickly, but quickly give him, kiss her quickly. I drew nearer, actually, to the cradle, and the baby in the cradle has a special smell. Believe me, that smell accompanied me during the whole 15 years in the prison, and up till now, even when I was released on 9/9/1999, this is my lottery number, and Fida now is laughing for sure. When I was released, even regardless what a perfume she wears, Hanin, I still, when I hug her, I still smell the same smell of that night of while she was in the cradle when they dragged me to the prison.
And you're listening to One Land, Many Voices. You're tuned to KBOO listener-sponsored community radio at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge, and also available as streaming audio at the KBOO website at kboo.fm. And we're talking with the deputy director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, Jaber Wisha, and his daughter, who is on the phone from Ann Arbor. Is that correct?
I'm from Michigan, Troy, Michigan.
Ah, Troy, Michigan. Now, we only have a few moments left in this conversation. I wonder, what do you want to leave our audience with in terms of what can citizens in this country do? And I leave this to both of you to address. What do they need to do to try to bring, first of all, an end to the struggle, the trials of both the families and the political prisoners in Israeli prisons, but also adjust peace to this conflict in Palestine?
Well, Fida, I'll give you the board. Please, go ahead, Fida.
Well, I said I wouldn't blame the people here because the media is not giving them the good picture about Palestine or the conflict in the Middle East in general. So I would like the people at least to listen to us, to know where Palestine is, what's happening in Gaza. Well, I couldn't do anything in the last events that were the war that was happening in Gaza. The only thing I could do is that wearing the T-shirt written on it, "Stop the war in Gaza," when I was going to the gym, just to let the people know that there is something wrong going on in Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. Any final thoughts?
Yes. I'll grasp this opportunity to address the audience to do every single effort. And here I appreciate the movement of solidarity with the Palestinians, with Gaza, through Free Gaza, and to break the siege about Gaza, and also those who are supporting solidarity, with solidarity, expressing their solidarity to the Palestinian people for just peace. I can ask the communities to exert influence on their representatives at the parliament in order to raise the issue of seeking just peace for the Palestinians, to stop this ongoing aggression offensive, and to stop this occupation. It is the key word for just and durable lasting peace in the Middle East and even in the globe. That occupation should come to an end. By ending the occupation, I think we can, with the Jews inside Palestine and all over the world, we can live all together in a democratic state. I think here explicitly and frankly, I call upon the Israeli people to choose. They should choose either marriage or divorce. If divorce, okay, live and let others live. Live in your own state and let the Palestinians live in their own state without any guardians, not imposing any guardians on them. They will choose their system, their regime, their life, and their way of life. And live in your great NATO Jewish state if you would like to have the divorce solution. But to have the marriage, okay, equal rights, equal duties, equal citizenship, this Holy Land, this area could be the country of all their citizenship on equal level. Without exerting any inferiority or superiority, on the same level, deal with all citizens and on the ground of a firm bedrock of human rights for all inhabitants and for all citizens.
And we've been listening to the Deputy Director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza, Mr. Jaber Wisha. Mr. Wisha, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, and I wish the best for all our audience, and thank you for this fantastic radio that gave me the chance to address on the other side of the globe and to share with them our feelings, our worries, our interests, and mainly our hope. We have also a dream in Palestine.
Thank you so much. And our next guest coming up is on the phone. He's going to wait just a few more moments while I tell folks that at 10 a.m. this morning, they can listen to Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. And at 10:15, hear Flashpoints featuring a talk by journalist and author Ali Abu Nima about what's going on in Gaza. So we'll return to that topic at 10:15 today with Ali Abu Nima. At 11 a.m., The Digital Divide presents the latest in science and technology affecting our planet with a focus on the recent South by Southwest Interactive Conference.
And our next guest this morning is a tireless young Israeli activist from the organization Anarchists Against the Wall. His name is Yonatan Pollack. And if you follow any of the remarkable protests against the apartheid wall in the Palestinian villages that have lost a lot of land to the building of the wall, then you already know some of these young men and this young man's hard work. Yonatan Pollack, thank you for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices. Are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Hello.
And Yonatan, let's start the conversation with the situation of Tristan Anderson, the man from the Bay Area who was just recently injured at protests taking place at a small Palestinian village. First, what is the latest news on Tristan Anderson's condition?
Tristan is still in the hospital in the ICU unit, still in critical condition, had underwent 4 brain surgeries. His condition is, in the last 2 days, is starting to get somewhat better, very slowly. But the extent of his injury is still not possible to determine the extent of his injury and the damage that he sustained.
And can you explain to us what was Tristan Anderson doing in this village, and what is the significance of Na'aleen?
Well, Na'aleen is one of many villages who resist. Who actively resist the wall in what can be described as a popular uprising, where people, basically the entire civilian population of the village, revolt against Israeli occupation and specifically against the construction of the wall on their lands in a way that will confiscate many of their few remaining lands, after a lot of their lands have been already been confiscated since 48 and then since 67. These demonstrations are joined by supporters both from Israel and worldwide. Tristan was one of them. Tristan's been to many different places in the world fighting for what he sees as justice or fighting injustice. Places like Central America, El Salvador, and Guatemala. He's been to Iraq. He's done a lot of anti-globalization activism. And he came here as well as one of those places where international activism is very welcome. And unfortunately, after being in all those very dangerous places, some of them a lot of us perceive as much more dangerous. If we think of Iraq and the West Bank, obviously we think of Iraq as much more dangerous. After being in all these places fighting for freedom, he's being hit so severely here in Palestine.
Yonatan, this is Will, and I just learned that my co-host, Wael, has also spent some time with you protesting the wall. We met a couple years ago at Belaïn, where similar protests have been taking place. What has been the outcome of these protests, and what's the idea behind them? What do you hope to achieve through these direct action protests at these different villages in the West Bank?
Well, the idea is of revolt, of insurrection against the occupation, and as Israelis, our goal is to support that insurrection because we see it as just. We see our duty in opposing our government and in revolting against it, because these things are being done in our name while we oppose them. It's very hard to frame the achievement of a movement, of a political movement, which is obviously a long-term thing. You could say that there's been some short-term achievements, such as rerouting of the wall and rerouting of the wall in some places. The returning of the return of some land, but. Generally, the aim of this movement is to—it's not really a separate movement of movement against the wall. It's part of the Palestinian insurrection against the occupation, and the goal is to create a situation of ingovernability, to create a situation where the Israeli occupation could not exist because it is being resisted by too many civilians. Obviously, this also brings about something very typical to colonialism and to resistance to colonialism, which is oppression. And in the last 4 years, we've had 17 unarmed demonstrators killed by the Israeli army, and countless people severely injured and imprisoned for varying amounts of time.
And now, there hasn't been significant political progress due to these protests, but have the protests grown among the Palestinians who are leading the protests, from what I understand? And also significantly, are there any more Israelis that are joining groups like Anarchists Against the Wall and going and protesting in solidarity with the Palestinians?
Well, if you compare the situation now to, let's say, 4 years ago, then definitely there are more Israelis. But I wouldn't really put the significance on Israelis. This is a Palestinian movement, and this is how it should stay. We definitely support Palestinian resistance, and we definitely participate in it. But through the realization that it is a Palestinian movement, and the important thing is the Palestinian participation in this demonstration. They're going to create their liberation, not us.
You mentioned that dozens have been killed in these different protests, and also many injured. What is the behavior of the Israeli troops that you're confronting? How do these injuries take place? And are the people who are injured, as is so often what we read here, they were throwing rocks or they were engaging in some other kind of form of violence? What's the actual truth of the situation there?
Well, there definitely is some occurrences of stone throwing, and like these are not non-violent protests. Nevertheless, the army's violence is completely, it's tenfold of Palestinian violence in these demonstrations. And also, there's a lot of discourse of Palestinians using violence and Israelis. The media's main discourse speaks of Palestinians using violence in these demonstrations generally, and the Israeli army only retaliating. Well, the situation on the ground is different. These people are under occupation and they're being assaulted on a daily basis. The stone throwing is a retaliation to Israeli violence, which is much, much more severe. No Israeli soldier had ever been killed in these demonstrations, and as I've said before, there have been 17 demonstrators killed. In the past weeks, we also see a heightening of the levels of violence and repression. The army has started using snipers on a regular basis, and almost in every demonstration, a few people are shot with shot by snipers with live ammunition. Just today, a young boy was shot right next to me. I was shot in the leg right next to me. The same day, Tristan Anderson was shot. Another person was shot in the leg. The week before that, we had four people shot in the leg with live ammunition. Now, I'll remind that these are civilian situations. We're not talking about warfare. We're talking about, at best, about policing actions where no live ammunition should be used, definitely not by snipers. These are not life-threatening situations for the soldiers. Live ammunition is used as crowd control, which under no circumstances should be the case.
Yonatan, we have a caller here for you. Caller, go ahead with your question, please. Hello, caller, are you there?
Is that me?
Yes, it is. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I'm also very proud of all the Israelis that support the Palestinian cause. Now, as far as the wall is concerned, my question is, do you think it's a fair wall or it's an apartheid wall? And my next little question is, do you think it's a good idea for the Israelis to trade places with the Palestinians for one day? What do you think of that? Thank you.
Well, first of all, there's nothing to be proud of us. I think it's our moral obligation to rise up against injustice, definitely when it's being done in our name. I think it's obvious. I mean, the question of whether it is a just war or an apartheid war is, I think, slightly irrelevant, because any war would be a bad idea. I think that separation is at the basis of apartheid, no matter if it's on the Green Line, on the internationally recognized border, or on Palestinian or on Palestinian land within 57, within the West Bank. But specifically, Israel is using a false pretext of security in order to steal land and to strengthen its strategic control over the West Bank. If you look at the path of the wall, it's very, very clear how it is built to secure Israeli control over the West Bank, to divide it into different cantons of discontinuity, to ensure that Israel controls the water resources in the West Bank, to ensure that Israel basically has ultimate control on the Palestinian civilian population and its movement, and this is all being done under the pretext of security, which is its fault. Regarding your last question, it's a bit hard for me to answer, because it's not a realistic suggestion. Israelis are not going to trade places with Palestinians, and I doubt that one day would seriously matter.
And with your description of what the wall is doing, separating the West Bank into cantons, moving on to the political situation, as an Israeli peace activist and organizer, what's your perspective on the return to power of Benjamin Netanyahu and the recent moves by Ehud Barak to have the Labor Party join his government? And what are the prospects for the two-state solution?
Well, I think, first of all, I think that the real differences between the right and the moderate and the Zionist left in Israel are basically symbolic. And that on the ground, there's never been much difference. It's a well-known fact that it was Labor government that built both settlements. And it was a right-wing government that signed the peace accord with Egypt. So the differences are mainly symbolic. I think what this government does signify is a further shift to the right in Israeli public opinion, because here symbols are important, and it's a general tendency that the Israeli public is undergoing for a long time, definitely since October 2000. Even before that. And there are some very scary figures in this government, such as Avigdor Lieberman, who is pretty much, he's a classic European fascist. It's not just using the word fascist as a derogatory term for a right winger. He is a proper fascist.
Yonatan, first of all, I want to remind our listeners that we're listening to a organizer with Anarchists Against the Wall, Yonatan Polak. Yonatan, can you tell us a little? We only have a few moments left here in the hour. Can you tell us a little bit about Anarchists Against the Wall and maybe how people in this country can support your work and the work of these protests in Palestine?
Anarchists Against the Wall is an organization of Israelis who support and join Palestinian popular resistance and the Palestinian uprising, while being very aware of our colonial status and taking Palestinian leadership, local leadership, in the villages that we work in. In past years, there's been a lot of legal persecution against us, culminating into over 120 indictments, 50 of them filed in the past 4 months. This obviously results in a lot of money issues, lawyer bills, et cetera. And this is our main problem right now. People who want to know more about us are welcome to look at our website, which is awall.org, awall.org. And there's also an option to donate there if people want to assist our legal battles with the state.
Yonatan, thanks so much for joining us this morning, and we hope to check back. And I also think that folks can find out the situation for Tristan Anderson as well at that website. So thank you for joining us.
Yes. Thank you for having me. Bye.
And I want to thank my co-host this morning, Wael. It was so good to have you here with me in the studio.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
And tell me a little bit about, we just have a minute here, but about Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights and how people can get in touch with that group here in Portland.
Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights is an organization that I co-founded with another local activist at Portland State University, and we've been doing a lot of educational and activist work at Portland State, hoping to inform the students of the situation in Palestine and Israel. And they can email us at super@pdx.edu. We don't have a website yet, but they can visit my personal website where a lot of information is linked in, and that's liberalarab.com.
Thanks very much. And we're coming to the end of the program here. I want to mention that you've been listening to One Land, Many Voices. If you'd like to tell us anything, what you think about the program, write us at pdxjustice@riseup.net. That's pdxjustice@riseup.net. And if you'd like to see a recent slide program by another representative from Anarchists Against the Wall, that's also at the website pdxjustice.org. That's all we have time for this morning. I want to thank our engineer, Todd, for a terrific job once again. And thank you all our listeners. Join us next month, fourth Friday of each month at 9 a.m. Here on KABU, listener-sponsored radio.
It is 10 o'clock and you're listening to 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM in Hood River, 100.7 FM in Corvallis in Albany, and you can find us on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints featuring a talk by journalist and author Ali Abu Nima about Gaza. And at 11, The Digital Divide presents the latest in science and technology affecting our planet with a focus on the recent South by Southwest Interactive Conference. Stay tuned to KABU.